Okay, Gabe, thank you so much for coming on the fourth episode of this AI safety series. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Before we get into your story, you are like the CTO and a co-founder of Conjecture, also an advisor to Control AI. Can you start off by telling us a bit about what these organizations do and what your role is in both of these?
So Conjecture was founded, I think, like 3 years ago now, with the goal of working on technical AI safety research. Specifically, initially, the goal was to work on the alignment problem. So that's for Conjecture. What I do there, I design the research agenda, the main technical directions to work on them. And that's most of my job at Conjecture. For Control AI, it's a nonprofit, which goal is to do policy and advocacy work on AI. there, I mostly advise. So people work on things and I try to give advice more at the strategic level, like the long-term directions. Lately, the DIP, if you've heard of it, like the direct institutional plan. So that's more the level at which I operate at Control AI.
You co-founded Conjecture with Sid Black and Connor Leahy. Connor's someone who's been, you know, pretty outspoken about AI and the risks and the worries he has around it. But you've been pretty quiet until now. Why is it that you've decided to start speaking, going on podcasts and so on lately?
I think there are two parts to this question. The first one is, why was I quiet up until now? And the other one is, why not anymore? I think the first one is mostly my personality. There's a thing called main character syndrome, where you want to be the main character of life and things like this. I think I have more the opposite of that. I like being, you know, geek in a cave or, you know, on a desert island. That's more my aesthetics. I think that when you're public, there are a bunch of problems, shit shows online and things like this that I quite dislike. I don't like the state of public discourse. I dislike a bunch of this. It's just that now timelines for me are short enough that I don't hope that public discourse will be like healed or improved in a reasonable time for me to be able to wait for this and then start contributing. So I'm coming into the trenches, basically.
Yeah, and before you moved into kind of AI safety, AI and so on, you worked in crypto. Can you tell us a bit about what you're up to there exactly?
I worked on what is called layer twos, so layer two solutions. So crypto has a lot of benefits compared to traditional computing, mostly deterministic semantics. What it means is that there's a clear definition for what an operation in crypto means, whereas in traditional programming, it's more an empirical thing. The meaning of the code is whatever happens, whereas in crypto, you have a more mathematical definition of what it does. And so I think crypto is one of the biggest systems in the world that has clear semantics for the actual programs that run. And downstream of this, there's a big focus on safety, security, and so on and so forth. And so with layer twos, what I wanted to build was basically a new infrastructure for the cloud, but that has those benefits of crypto. There are other benefits I cared about, which is like crypto had the early internet thing of having open protocols that anyone can plug themselves onto. Anyone can build software to integrate with blockchains and things like this. And I liked this vibe quite a lot. So that's more the practical work. The theoretical work was more like idealistic. The way I phrased it when I was younger was that to make money, either you get money from someone else or you create money. And I was very interested in the idea of like creating a currency, basically.
Eventually, you pivoted into kind of AI safety. I know that some interactions, experience with GPT-3 was part of it. Like, what happened there exactly? What did you see, and how did that change your direction in life?
What did Ilya see?
What did Gabe see? Yeah.
The internet when I was younger was a very, very different place. and a big part of it was, now we will say underground, but before it was like quite normal, you know, chat rooms on IRC, on forums and things like this. And you'd have a lot of people talk about AI, AGI. And if you looked at how people try to design their own AGI systems, there would always be at some point, you know, a box in the drawing that would go understand human language, ? Or recognize patterns, ? And things like this. And the thing is that when I saw GPT-3, I was like, yep, this is actually filling the missing component of many of those how to build AGI schemas. So that from that point on, it was not a research problem anymore. It was mostly an engineering problem. Now we had a way to solve the missing components for like all those AGI projects. So for me, this was like the main one. And I was always worried about alignment, not necessarily AI alignment, just like general alignment. And with this, I was like, yeah, my timeline just got much shorter. I think most people in AI, most people in ML did not expect that we'll have an artifact like GPT-3 in 2020. When I was younger, thinking of a program that will understand human language that much was like a thing that was like decades in the future. It was like supposed to be a 2050 type of thing. And this is like, if you're optimistic, a fun gimmick that I like in this vein is that if you look at any piece of science fiction before 5 years ago that features AIs, the AIs will have a robotic voice. It's like, it's supposed to take place, you know, decades in the future or sometimes centuries in the future, and they all have a robotic voice. Because no one predicted that we'll get, you know, realistic deepfakes like by 2020 or 2022 or something like this. And the same is true for understanding language. It's like, they will speak with like robot quirks and things like this. They wouldn't speak like natural humans and so on and so forth. And so just everyone was wrong. I was wrong. I was part of this everyone. It was like, yep, my AGI timeline just got shortened massively, basically. I think this reckoning still hasn't propagated. I think a lot of people are acting as if nothing happened or as if it was obvious all along, which I think is not very humble.
You said you'd always been interested in alignment more broadly and not just AI alignment. What did you mean by that exactly?
I think there's a very natural problem that everyone feels, which is we use systems that are more complex than individual humans, and we don't know how to align them. Example of those are like companies, markets, governments, groups of people. Very often it feels like the groups has a spirit of its own that doesn't reflect the actual beliefs of any member. And basically at large, we don't know how to align those things reliably. We have a bunch of heuristics that prevent them from doing too much damage and sometimes getting some benefit out of it, but we wouldn't really call it alignment. We don't perceive ideologies as being humane. Very often, like even just using the word ideology has like negative connotations. If you think of a company, you will rarely think about it as trying to do what's right for humans, and you will try to think about it as like a profit maximizing engine or something like this. And if I speak of governments, then you'd think of something like a waste maximizing engine or something like this. Like we just all have the feelings that we don't know how to marshal, control, align those very big systems. And that's what I mean by like general alignment. I got worried when I was young about climate change, about nuclear warfare, about bioweapons. And basically my feeling was something like, if tomorrow we get mega nukes, you know, nukes that are like 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times more powerful than what we have, or 1,000,000 times cheaper than what we have, you know, everyone can build a nuke in their garage, I don't think this goes well. And this property of things going well when we gain more power is what I mean by general alignment. Right now, it doesn't feel like we live in a world, we live in societies where if everyone becomes more powerful, or even if a few individuals become much more powerful, we expect things to go well. And that's what I mean by like general alignment. I think it's a thing that we all feel to some extent.
Maybe we'll just stay here for a second longer then. So AI alignment, how do you understand what that is exactly? And if I'm right, I think that I think maybe the way that a lot of people think about it is perhaps the wrong way to be thinking about it.
For me, it's basically solving the general alignment problem. let's say you have a powerful system, how do you have it go well? A way to think about it is, you know, what will be a constitution that is solid enough that if tomorrow it's announced that you have a global government implementing that constitution, you feel great about it. You know, what is a set of moral principles, like the true morals, where you're like, yep, we got it. We understand morals. This is it. And we tell you that tomorrow there's a world government that implements it. You feel good about it. For me, like, that's the core question of alignment. And then you have AI alignment, which is, you know, a mix of a bunch of questions, which is one, the general alignment question, two, how do you implement it onto an AI system, and three, how do you ensure that as the system becomes more powerful, changes itself, or changes as a result of its interactions with its environment, it keeps implementing this solution. For me, we're stuck at step one. And step one is like a pretty big problem that, you know, mixes psychology, sociology, morals, ethics, politics, like political philosophy and things like this. And those are problems that are so far out what we can currently do. Like right now, you know, I think our scientific method as it exists right now is not good enough to tackle those problems, that it feels like working on, you know, how would you implement principle X in an AI? Like, very misguided. It's like we're not even there. We don't even know what a good principle would be. Like, if someone tomorrow came up with like a good understanding of morals, we would not be able to distinguish this guy from a crank, for instance. So I think this is more where the difficulty is. You know, even if we have epic interpretability, we can see what's going on in the minds of AIs or whatever. First, those AIs are very alien, and we have an understanding of intelligence that doesn't, you know, really extrapolate beyond humans. So that's even clear that with perfect interpretability, we understand what will happen in their brain. But then understanding the consequences of the way they see morals, it's like we don't understand the consequences of how we see morals. Like, the you don't want to take any ethical system right now and just give it all the power. And you wouldn't either take a portfolio of ethical systems and be like, oh, this is the correct morals. Like, so this is where I feel the bottlenecks are, and much less so in like interpretability or actually building AGI.
Come back to this, some of your specific thoughts on AI stuff in a second. Just talk a little bit more about your story. So yeah, so after this GPT-3 moment, before you co-founded Conjecture, you spent some time at Luther AI. What did you do there? Yeah, can you tell us what you did at Luther AI, and then perhaps the story by which you co-founded Conjecture? How did that happen exactly?
I was not an active member at Luther AI. It's more that historically, whenever I wanted something in a field, I would just look for the online communities around that field, look for the biggest ones, and then contact people there. That's where you'd see a lot of, you know, the early research and so on and so forth. I had done the same previously, you know, in crypto. I had done the same previously in like academic computer science. I just look for the spaces online where you can easily contact people. So before this, you know, it was IRC mailing lists, .edu websites. At the time of AI, it was Discord. So I went on Discord and I looked for the biggest AI Discord that had people doing things, and it was Luther AI. So I went there. I looked at who the admin was. It was Connor. So I just started messaging him. I was like, the AI thing is huge. You have access to like epic talent pool. You have, you know, great marketing. You should leverage this into building big things. And personally, I cared about AI safety, and he already cared about AI safety back then. So I was like, let's try to build something huge with AI safety. So basically, talked to him to death for months until like a year and a half later, he accepted and we co-founded Conjecture, basically.
And Conjecture have like worked on a few different things since you started. Can you talk us a bit about the journey of Conjecture ending up with the specific research agenda you're focused on now, a cognitive emulation. So can you run us through that?
I think there are two halves in the life of conjecture. In the first one, we basically wanted to explore as many different venues of alignment work as possible. So we hired different people with different agendas. We did some work on interpretability, some work on LLM psychology, some more theoretical fundamental work. We built our own incubator at some point called Refine and overseen by Adam Shimi. We got a bunch of people from the incubator trying, you know, even more crazy things. So that's like the first half. Our main conclusion is that most of the existing venues were not meaningful. Let's put it that way. Basically, alignment is much too hard to make progress on right now. There's a degradation, a weaker version of alignment that people are also interested in, which is corrigibility, which is instead of making systems that are aligned with human values, make systems that can be corrected over time. So the usual one is build an AI agent that has a goal, but is also not resistant to being turned off. At the limit with like super intelligent agents, this is still like a much too hard problem. So instead, what we try to think about is how to build AI systems that do not accidentally, square quotes, become too powerful. What I mean by this is that right now, if you have an AI system that doesn't know how to perform a specific task, the usual fix is you wait for the next generation of models, or you fine-tune it on thousands of samples. And fundamentally, you don't really understand the task, you don't really understand the capabilities of your AI model and things like this. And so the conclusion of the current paradigm is that whenever the models are not good enough, we just build bigger black boxes. This does not end well. So then we get to the second part of conjecture, which is how do we build AIs that do not have this property, such that when there's a task that they cannot perform, a fact that they're missing, a rule that we want to enforce, we can, in effect, just teach them this fact, this pattern, enforce this specific rule, and so on and so forth. So that was the idea of cognitive emulation. The goal of cognitive emulation was we take any task that is well understood by a human, we look at the type of algorithms that humans implement because we can understand that, and we try to actually implement specifically this. So specifically implementing things that we understand as humans instead of building bigger black boxes. So that was the goal of cognitive emulation. In effect, a lot of our work was based on fine-tuning. So constraining fine-tuning such that after fine-tuning, the model will only learn the things that we want. And so that was the reasoning behind our agenda, cognitive emulation.
You guys decided to run Conjecture as a for-profit organization. A lot of organizations in this field are kind of grant-funded, like kind of not-for-profits. A lot of them are funded by, you know, kind of the effective altruism field. Why is it you guys decided to go down this for-profit route, and how's that been?
Connor talked a lot about it. The way he presents it is like the 21st century, the engine of building new orgs with a lot of money is like VC. And VC is for profit. So if you want to have a lot of money to build your org to solve any type of new problem, you go the VC route. That's where you can get the most money. So that's what we did. It's also not a traditional nonprofit or charity. Is that even if it's with grants, you're still not taking donations from individuals and things like this. So there are a bunch of like administrative complexities that do not really make sense. You know, it's not like a Red Cross spin-off that is getting money from people and using it for agreed ahead of time goals and things like this. Here it's more a thing where we had to course correct a lot. Like the entire first half of Conjecture was just trying many different approaches. So it's more, it's more the for-profit route. You wouldn't have needed to be for-profit possibly in, you know, a perfect world. There will just be a government agency that has, you know, a shit ton of money to dedicate to the problem, and they will have dedicate as much money as VCs gave us to work on this problem. It's just in the 21st century, in the Western world, if you want a lot of money to work on a big problem and big and novel problem, the best place for this is like the VC ecosystem. So that's more the reason.
Another thing that you've worked on, you've put out there, is this great document called the Compendium. Can you say a bit about what the Compendium includes, like what information is in the Compendium, and why you guys wrote it, like what impact you're trying to have putting this piece out?
The true answer is fairly simple. It's that we believe that at current pace, you know, the progress in AI leads to human extinction. We think it's really bad. We think it's not very well explained. And specifically not the reasons why we believe it. And so we're like, there should be at least a piece of writing that explains our beliefs. Regardless of the goals, it's like, deontologically, we should do this. This is a big problem. We should express our opinion. So that's like the genesis of the Compendium. So it's explaining how we understand AI right now, why we think that if you extrapolate, we get to like superintelligence, why we think that superintelligence is dangerous, why we think the danger is more than a risk. It's like the default outcome, and the type of stuff that we think should be done or could be done to prevent the default outcome.
Maybe someone watching this is not at all familiar with AI and AI safety stuff. So kind of drawing on the Compendium, if you were to explain to someone who's never even considered this, you know, why it might be the case, or in fact you think very likely to be the case, that AI can lead to something as bad as human extinction, could you explain how you see that happening?
I think there are two parts to this question. The first one is why from current AIs we see or we expect that we could get to godlike systems, and like fairly quickly, not over millennia, but like over years or decades. For this one, the reasoning is like fairly straightforward. Anything that humans can do can be replicated by machines. There is a core that is enough to then be able to learn anything else, which we usually call general intelligence. That's how we operationalize, you know, general intelligence. The thing where if you have it, you can then learn how to perform any other task. As long as, you know, there's a physical process that makes it possible to perform the task, like any task that is physically possible. So we think that this exists and that humans have this property, or that humanity has this property. Like if there's a physical solution that is outlined, we can learn how to implement this, basically. We think that AIs can have this property. The reason why is that for all the things that humans can do, we are now building AIs that can do this. And we do not think that there's like a magic property in humans that is not replicable with AIs. So that's the first one, is why we expect that from current AI research we'll get AGI. And then there's the question of what we expect after AGI. So after AGI, we expect that we can get something that goes through many, many different names. One is the intelligence explosion, one is recursive self-improvement, a newer one is automated AI R&D, which I like because it's like very descriptive. It's like just doing AI R&D, but fully automated with only AI, no humans in the loop. Our expectation is because of, you know, hardware, software, algorithmic, but even more epistemic improvements, you can get systems that are much faster and much better at thinking than people. And so can discover technologies like much faster than what we can right now. So common metaphor is imagine the last 100, 200 or 500 years of technology, of technological progress, but only in the next month. We expect that it's the type of stuff that is possible with powerful AI systems. And the thing is that this then is put in service of AIs. And the type of powerful systems that you get with, you know, technologies basically from the future, much smarter than like humanity combined and so on and so forth, looks to be extremely powerful. Like we can max the laws of physics. We have done so for some technology. For instance, you know, with optical fiber communication, we send information nearly at the speed of light. And the laws of physics have, you know, a lot of leeway for like energy production, speed of travel, distraction potential, and things like this. And we expect that if you have much more technological progress, you get much closer to this, and those are very dangerous regimes. So that's why we think it's dangerous. It still doesn't explain why it's the likely outcome, but you know, only so much that can fit in a question.
So we talked about conjecture. This other organization that you help with is Control AI. I think you're an advisor to them. What are Control AI trying to do exactly?
So the spicy answer. I think there's a deep question, which is why build a new safety organization that does advocacy and policy, because there are already many others. The problem is that in our experience, most of the others are basically playing House of Cards. I don't know if you know the show. So in the show, you have this guy, I think Frank, that wants to become president of the US and does this in the most underhanded ways possible. You know, he's shrewd, cunning, and so on and so forth. And that's most of what we've seen in policy. A lot of people will like network, will never state publicly their true beliefs, specifically around extinction risks, because, you know, it's outside of the Overton window and so on and so forth. And simply enough, we, in French, you have colorful language like ça me casse les couilles, which is like, it doesn't sit nicely with me. And instead, we wanted to build an organization that was just clear in what they believe. This is the type of organization that will write the compendium instead of writing, you know, a very PC brief that is very within the Overton window and talks about AI risks that they don't actually care about, just to be like, oh, AI bad or something like this. Whereas we don't think AI bad. We think that there are nice things, we think there are bad things, we think there are extinction risks that should be mitigated, and we don't think we should move the Overton window. We think we should be honest and just explain it like it is to people, to policymakers, and that's why we built this organization fundamentally. Some people call this the inside game, the fact of, you know, doing the networking. And, you know, a lot of people tell us that inside game is necessary and things like this. Even accepting this premise, we think there should be at least one org that is just, you know, unabashedly honest and just tries to explain to policymakers the situation like it is. And a lot of people told us that policymakers will not be receptive to this, that, you know, they're like stupid, corrupt, or things like this. This has not been our experience. So sometimes they're not convinced, but very often it's for reasonable reasons. Sometimes they don't understand the topic, so they cannot form a confident opinion. And we think the solutions to this is like education rather than shrewdness. And so we wanted to build an org that actually uses those methods.
You're kind of transitioning more, if I'm correct, to like more kind of policy work than technical stuff, because I guess you see the bigger importance of that these days. Like, yeah, what is this, what you see now? You think the influencing government, influencing policy is just more of a critical part than you thought about a few years ago? What's kind of changed there for you?
As time passes, timelines shorten. We made a bet on some technical agenda. It did not pan out in time. So right now we think that the most pressing thing is just buying more time for more technical work, because there's not enough right now. That's mostly it. I also say something that is like not like our frame or point of view is not necessarily influencing government or influencing people. I think it's more right now education and explaining. We think that there's like a good process in democracy that starts with education and explaining. Then people build their opinions, and then you can, you know, argue against, with, and so on and so forth, and you can think about influencing. But it doesn't feel like we're past that first step. So that's like not even our priority right now. Like, influencing is just a zero-sum game at first. Like, if people don't have fully formed opinions, there's no reason for truth to win. So in this situation, what happens is just, you know, war of influences between factions in a way that is like completely disconnected from who is right. And we don't think participating in those games is like very fruitful. So instead, we're thinking more about education, explaining, and things like this, which is why we write documents like the compendium, the narrow path, and soon like policy paper that is more in the vocabulary of like government officials, NetSec analysts and things like this.
This episode is part of what I've called the AI safety series. I saw like a tweet of yours where you said, you know, this word AI safety is a bit of a misnomer, and you kind of see these four different groups that kind of fall under this term AI safety. Can you talk about that and what you see here?
I forgot what are the four that I listed in this specific tweet, but now I mostly think about three. I think there's one that we can refine into subgroups, and that might have been the thing. So the three groups that I think of in AI safety are, one, the people who think that AI will not grow big, basically. That, you know, AI will not come before, you know, centuries or something like this, or even at all, it might be impossible. And so those AI safety people usually care more about fairness, bias, ethics, and things like this, because they care more about the harms that past systems will be likely to do. Not even current systems. Current systems are like already well beyond this. That's more what they think of. You have another type which thinks that ASI is possible and likely soon, but that alignment is basically just a matter of are the nice people building AI? That if it's nice people building it, then it should be okay. Those people, their priority is mostly being in the organization that will build AGI and making sure that they are the nice people and that the bad people do not do AGI. When I say this, I'm not thinking of US versus China. The main thing that I'm thinking is like OpenAI versus DeepMind versus Anthropic. They are mainly competing with each other. Like China is a more recent one, and I don't know if it's as serious as each of them for now. Possibly later, but not now. So this is like a second side of AI safety, which is like ASI, yes, but alignment mostly easy, or just a matter of being nice and putting in some effort. And then there is a separate group that is like ASI likely in next few decades, next few years, and alignment hard, like beyond our current methods, like being nice will not be enough. You know, sometimes you're nice and you still get screwed. And it's like this type of situation, like being nice is not enough. We actually either need more time or need to do the type of research that we haven't done in like ever in the next 5 to 10 years. And so this group is like much more worried about risk of extinction from AI. And their main priority is just buying more time, which is they will usually phrase as, you know, pause AI, stop AI and things like this. But the main thing is we need more time to deal with this.
I mean, you obviously take it very seriously and think it's likely that, you know, this is going to lead to extinction. Does this have any kind of psychological toll on you? Like, what impact does this have on you, having this, you know, quite unusual belief that, you know, most people don't kind of go around with in their head day to day?
There's a wise man who once said, it is what it is. You know, I think we all went through this. At some point, you realize that you will die and you feel really bad about it. And then you realize that people close to you will die, and then you feel really bad about it. But you keep on living and you try to do your best. Ideally, collectively, we decide to work on immortality because, you know, dying is bad and we don't like our close ones dying. This is, you know, one of the other signs that we're in a good world. It's like an actual goal that humanity has, and we track the milestones and we track how well we're doing, and we even have an estimated percentage of like how far we are in eradicating death. So from a point of view, it feels like this. It feels, yeah, like by default, I expect I will die and people close to me will die. So I think this is already sad. And I think the type of grieving that you have to do, you know, with regard to extinction is not like qualitatively different. I think it's more thinking about it in shorter terms and things like this. But I think it's a very human experience. we are for now finite. Possibly if we succeed and if we manage everything, we can get to a world where we're not forced to die. But until then, it's the reality of the current world. And I think that this is a thing that everyone has to grasp with, not only people who care about short-term extinction risks.
Is there like a standout personal lesson that you think you've learned during your period working on these issues that you'd like to share with people?
Oh, yeah. People are much too cynical. the number of times I've heard, oh, but like, you know, politicians do not care about anything and everyone is too fucking stupid and no one cares about anything and so on and so forth, is like crazy. I always hear like smart people being like, oh, it's impossible to do anything. It's like impossible to affect anything, blah, 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 blah. I think this is way too cynical. If I was, you know, a psychoanalyst, I would say it's just a defense mechanism such that it motivates you doing nothing, you know, so that you can defend your laziness. But fortunately, I'm not a psychoanalyst. I think is that it's not obvious. It's not obvious what made democracy worked. Like, democracy worked a lot. Like, with much less technology than we have right now, we got, you know, hundreds of years of, like, scientific and moral progress. It's just that we do not understand how this came to be. We do not understand how, despite the lack of technology, we still managed to coordinate quite a bit. You know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is like a beautiful document that we actually drafted 70 years ago and we acted upon. It's like, how do we do this now? And I think it is possible. I think it is much easier than it was in the past. We're all much more like, everyone has access to much more education than we had like 80 years ago. People are much less extremist than we were 80 years ago. 80 years ago, we had actual Nazis and like hardline authoritarian killer communists. So it's like people are much tamer than they were 80 years ago. They are much more educated. We have much more technology. We can talk to anyone in the entire world in less than a second. It's like, it's advanced and crazy and epic. And so I think that coordination is much more tractable. You know, you've asked me what does the world look in 5 years and I'm happy about it. I think it can exist a month from now. I think it's genuinely possible that with people spending time to work on coordination in isolation, not everyone together, just all the smart people being overly cynical, spending like 50% of their time, you know, ruminating about cynicism and anxiety instead thinking of how can I coordinate with others, and you do take the topic that they know about and contact their politicians, their representatives to educate them about it, contact other people to educate them about it, create Discord servers to work on those topics and things like this. I think with just this, we can do like crazy things. And the reason why I believe this is that we've done crazier things with less. So now it should be like way easier. Like, we have smarter people, much better educated, and we've tools that let you meet people everywhere in the world in less than a second, which did not exist 80 years ago. Like, this is a new thing that makes the impossible possible. So I think that will be the thing that I want people to have in mind. It's like, there's way too much cynicism. It's actually much easier than it ever was to do big change. And you can even work on it individually. Not everyone needs to just. You can just do it by yourself separately and still get to nice results. Like, that will be the thing that I want people to have in mind. The people are amenable. People want good things to happen. If you do it individually, you'll find a lot of support from people. Like, the world is a better place than what it seems. It's still not on the good path, but it's still in a much better place, and this change is tractable. Which is why, you know, I'm working on conjecture and control AI and not, you know, fucking off to Okinawa and chilling in a desert island. It's because I think it can actually be done.
This is very interesting because, you know, on the one hand, you believe that we're on this bad path, and perhaps more than an average person, you see this worst possible outcome, you know, happening. But everything you've said there is just this very incredibly optimistic, you know, you're someone who really believes we can do these great things. So it's not at all that, you know, you're some pessimist who kind of thinks the world's going to end, it's all bad. It feels like, from everything you've said, that you believe much more the opposite, you know, these great things can happen than a typical person thinks, and you're really against cynicism and stuff, which is refreshing and nice, you know.
I mean, for me, there are like two separate questions. It's like, what is the default outcome, assuming we don't change what we do? And then there's how hard it is to change what we do. And I just think of them as two very different questions. I think on the current outcome, on the current, you know, baseline, we're directed toward a very bad outcome, like actual human extinction. But I also think it's like easier than almost any other time in history to change this. We actually have the technology, we actually have the education, the understanding to actually build a great future for ourselves. I just think it should be done. Like, I think we should actually try. You know, it's like eradicating death. We're like closer to eradicating death than we ever been in history. We should have the eradicating death counter. We should see like how much of world GDP is going in there. We should see what are the sub goals, like according to the main theory of how we can eradicate death and how well we're doing on each of those sub goals. This should be kept track of. And I think we should do the same thing of like global coordination, alignment, solving morals, you know, like how close are we to an actual complete understanding of morals? And the thing is, we can do those things. We can just keep track of this. And for me, the complexity of keeping track of this is much lower than other problems that we have solved. We have gone to the moon, like, you know, before the internet. like the moon in the sky. Like, you see what I mean? Like, we can keep track of progress on the whiteboard that we just, you know, film and broadcast to the entire world. Like, it can be a whiteboard that just a guy updates every day. This counts. Like, you see what I mean? It's like clearly possible. Like, that's mostly how I think about it. I think there are many things that are possible that are even cheap and easy with current tech. I just think that paradoxically, the main obstacle is like too much cynicism. We have a lot of resources. We have a lot of people that are smart enough to do this type of stuff. It's just there's too much cynicism that prevents them from actually attempting this. I don't know if this counts as pessimism or optimism. It's just...
feels optimism, but yeah. Okay, no, that's good. That's great. So final question. Always ask everyone the same thing to end the show. Not a small question.
Yeah, lots of big questions.
So Gabe, yeah, the question is, what do you think it means to live a good life?
There's like what I want for myself and what I want for the world. And, you know, I have different budget for each of those. I spend some time on the first one and sometimes on the second one. Some money on the first one, some money on the second one. For the world, it's mostly the humanist worldview that I think the best thing to do is to actually put in the work such that the world gets to a place where everyone can work toward their happiness. So it's not necessarily that I want to bring people happiness, but I want to be in a world where people can grab it for themselves. Like, it's an actual feasible possibility for everyone to get there. So for me, that's like the collective thing. For the personal one, I just want to go to Okinawa and eat nice food and spend time with my friends and family. I'm a simple person. Like, I like reading books, playing video games, doing my sports and chilling. It's not that complicated. Like, you see what I mean?
That's fine. We don't need a profound answer.
Like,
I appreciate the honesty. We don't need a profound answer.
Yeah, so, yeah. I like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. If you like, we can roll.
Nice.
Yeah, on a personal level, it's quite simple. I just want my family and friends to be nice, to be chill, to be happy, and I want to spend time with them.
That's a great way to end it. Gabe, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate all of the work you're doing and that message of kind of optimism and call to action at the end. So thanks for your time and good luck with everything.
Yeah, thanks a lot, and I wish you best for your podcast.
I hope you enjoyed today's interview. If you did, please support the channel by hitting the subscribe button below. See you next time.